Welcome to the ONC PCOR Research Data Use Scenarios Workgroup Meeting Number 6. My name is Hilda and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Priscilla Adula.
Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to sort of our sixth meeting. And so this has sort of become a regular item every 2 weeks. My name is Priscilla, and joining me on the call, we have other members of the NORC team, which include Eric, Gargan, Lauren, and Catherine, our colleagues from GW, Jane, Lara, and Elizabeth Gray, and we also have Daniela Mika and Joanna Singerano on the call. Also joining us from ONC, we have Helen Gayton-Peters and Debbie Massa. Okay. You know, we are taking note of everyone that's sort of joining via the WebEx, and we'll be sure to note, you know, sort of all of your participation in our meeting summaries. I'm not going to sort of call upon everyone on the phone at the moment. For today's meeting, we are going to walk through sort of three new scenarios that we've worked on. And, you know, sort of the ideas for these scenarios have actually come from the prior workgroup meetings. So to start out with, we have two focused on special populations, one prisoners and one is decisionally disabled. And you may recall there was sort of a very lively conversation that we had with all of you in our last meeting where, you know, I think there was sort of this collective desire that we break out these special populations and, you know, around a specific research data use scenario. So we have done that. And then we're also going to be discussing one about linking data across institutions via research identifier. And so this is one that actually came out from one of our very early meetings where we talked about combining claims and clinical data that was sort of independently held, you know, across different entities. And so we'll, you know, get into that as well. And then as time permits, you know, we'll also walk through some other scenarios where we've received some ideas, and then, you know, go through some logistics and next steps, okay? All right, so just, you know, we begin this up because we'd like this to sort of be a constant reminder to all of you that, you know, if we're thinking about each of these research data use scenarios, you know, we are sort of focusing on these key question areas. We've worked very closely with the team at GW to come up with these questions so that if they take the next step in developing the legal and ethical framework, they have sort of the important inputs that they need to sort of build that out, okay? So at this point, Daniela, I'm going to hand it over to you, and I'm going to bring up the first scenario on prison populations, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead, Daniela.
Okay. So as everybody can see, this is an image from the Confluence site. As Priscilla mentioned, we had been discussing how we can capture how prison populations should be treated differently in the context of data sharing. And so Eric had developed this scenario in working out the kinds of data that might be particularly of interest and raise questions of greater than minimal risk. And so this approach is an idea that would come from an RCT that could only be done on prison populations regarding reentry into the general population. So it's a double blind randomized trial. The IRB has approved the trial, and the workflow that would occur during the trial involves infectious disease nurses screening prisoners and identifying if they're seropositive and other inclusion criteria, including opiate dependence, conducting informed consent, and meeting the age criteria. And so once eligibility has been determined, the patients and prisoners will be enrolled in the trial, and their data will be collected for the purposes of understanding what kinds of recidivism rates and dependency outcomes might happen before and after these kinds of treatments. So while this is an RCT, I think that in order for discussing this with this group, we want to be thinking about the data risks rather than any of the risks that might be incurred for participating in a trial of a particular treatment. So we've tried to in the description here de-emphasize that the risks and concerns and ethical concerns that come with engaging prison populations in trials that are trying out new treatments, and instead considering what the data concerns are. So these are the kinds of questions that we thought you guys might be able to weigh in on. So are there any protections that should be afforded to the incarcerated populations with respect to the authorization of the data release? And the eligibility for that data release prior to consent. So in order to even identify these potential participants in the trial, there needs to be some kind of data that's being released from that initial screening by the nurse. And how should we address that in prison populations? When we're thinking about the consent for the data use for researchers, what kinds of protections might be afforded to these populations that would be different from other kinds of populations that would not be incarcerated? Should there be additional privacy protections on top of what other concerns should be afforded for data security and confidentiality? And are there other kinds of considerations that might apply if the screening data was collected as part of normal prison intake, as opposed to a screening that was happening specifically as part of research procedures? So these are the things that we brought up, and then we have the usual description that I think you guys are used to seeing here of the scenario. And there's a couple different alternatives that had been raised here. So would these considerations be different if there was some kind of a drug court mandate that they would be obligated to participate in treatment programs for substance use and HIV care? And then whether there was a difference between 21 and over versus 21 and under, and the kinds of ethical concerns that might be under consideration for data that was being drawn from those two slightly different populations. So let me just pause and bring it back to the questions here and see what people had in mind in terms of things that we should be considering for this scenario that might not have been raised here.
So first on the phone, everyone's lines are unmuted, so you can either just let us know you have a comment, or you can raise your hand. But yeah, we are very interested in sort of hearing from you on other questions we should bring up, or refinements on these sort of existing questions, or any other experiences that you might have that might allow us to sort of refine what we are putting forward here. Bob Galman, do you want to go ahead? I see you have your hand raised.
Yeah, hi. I want to go back. You don't have to move backwards to the key questions, because one of the questions that wasn't there is what rules apply to the data that you're dealing with, because different data from different sources may come with a different set of rules, laws, conditions, requirements, obligations, just depending on exactly what the source is. You know, in this case, if there is data being obtained from, a program subject to Part 2, then the data is subject to Part 2. And that creates its own problems in this particular circumstance.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Are there any special considerations for part two that might be particularly complex for prison populations? Do you think it's going to be a different kind of challenge in part two? I think this is part two has certainly been an active part of our discussion, and I can see certain ways in which this would make it even more complicated than it is. Do you have any comments on that intersection between these populations in part two?
Not off the top of my head. I mean, I know there's a rulemaking on part two out on the street. I haven't looked at it yet, and I don't know whether there's anything in there that'll be relevant. But basically, part two is so restrictive in a lot of ways and puts obligations on people that they don't necessarily expect that by itself creates problems. It's just not your ordinary run-of-the-mill research data. But in terms of, it's been a long time since I've read through all of part two. I think there is some stuff in there specifically about, I'm not sure. I'm not going to say that. Anyway, maybe somebody else has some insight.
I think this is good for us having the lawyers take a look at it, because I think that there are specific exceptions to people who are under court orders and are referred, which is why we put it under there for the for drug court. If a person is referred to treatment by the courts, their data are not restricted by Part 2. But I think this is what we exactly wanted to do was to raise these questions up so that then they can be put into the framework.
And just a clarification, too, I think it's, typically if someone is incarcerated, they are not going to be in a Part 2 covered entity. So they're sort of, they could go from being incarcerated to being released into the community and to afford a CFR Part 2 or clinic, but those would probably be separate, and I don't think they overlap quite as much, so... Just a clarification there.
Any other sort of questions or comments or issues that our stakeholder group wants to raise around this particular scenario? Jane and Lala, did you have any sort of follow-up or comment?
Priscilla, this is Jane. No, just that I think the underlying issue raised about the question as to the different laws and regulations, I think that's embedded underneath all of the questions, but it's a helpful point. Thank you.
Hello. Hi.
Go ahead.
My name is Asia, and I'm from the Office of the Chief Privacy Officer, and one of the questions that you may want to consider is, I'm very new to this, but when you're talking about the data and its release and in responding to incarcerated populations, generally the rules in HIPAA in regards to receiving consent are different for the prison population in general, and so they don't have the same rights of access as do people who are not incarcerated. However, based under HIPAA, those rights and privileges will remain, and they will be retroactive once the person is released. So I know that there are different exceptions on working with prison systems and doing different types of research. If it has something to do with like public health and there's a process for that. However, I think that there might need to be some type of consent process for those who, it depends on the population that you're trying to study. Are you studying people that have been incarcerated for a number of years? Are you going to study people who will only be in prison for maybe a year? So, like, there needs to be a time limit, because you would really run into an issue with consent issues that I see would pop up. It's for a population, if the person is only sentenced for over a year or two and this study lasts longer than that or maybe shorter, for those people that are released, they tell you they don't want their records, or they might not want to be a part of this project, and they can say that the day that they're released, as opposed to someone else who's going to be in prison for the rest of their life. So to me, it depends on the population or the demographics of the population in which you're trying to study.
This is Marisa in OCR. I just wanted to clarify is something that, so although there are, there's a limitation in the rule on prisoners or individuals in a correctional institutions getting a copy of their own information, there isn't anything in the rule about treating prisoners differently with respect to their authorizing information held by the correctional facility, to the extent that, say, a clinic there is a HIPAA covered entity, to a researcher. So they wouldn't be treated differently than anyone else for that purpose.
Correct.
Marissa, thank you. Isha, thank you for the comment. I thought, Thornton Payne, did you want to make a comment? I see that you had your hand raised for a moment. Did you want to make a comment?
Yes, I just had a question. In terms of the description of the scenario, so is the fact that the population is all that the study outcomes are all measured after prisoners are released, is that by design or is that because of the regulations in place?
That was by design. This is looking at the impact on relapse and on recidivism. So the outcomes of interest are post release.
Okay.
And I think, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your motivation for making those the outcomes was to actually help us discuss the ways in which the ethical and legal constraints might change pre and post release in part around the data. Is that
That's
one of the
correct.
Reasons why you picked this? Okay.
That's correct, yeah.
And this is Asia. Can I just have a question? For the person that may be with OCR, wouldn't there be a difference? It seems like the last person who just made a comment is stating that there will be a difference between the person while they're incarcerated and their right to their data as opposed to their rights while they are or when they exit. Is that true or not true?
I guess I wasn't hearing how the research involves their own access to the data. Is that part of this?
This really is not particularly involved in the subject's access to their health information. Rather, it is these are patient or subjects who are recruited while in jail and are followed post-release to see what the impact is medication on their relapse and recidivism, and interaction with the criminal justice system. So their access to their health
okay.
information is not particularly a significant issue here.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments on this one? Otherwise, I will move us on to the next one. Bob, did you have another comment? I see your hand is up.
Yeah, I did. I see here that you provided an assumption that there's a certificate of confidentiality, which I think is essential. But there is at least one case that I know of where the court just basically blew right through the certificate and ordered the underlying data to be made available. And I think that's a real significant risk here in this particular kind of a scenario. And I don't know quite what to do about it. But it may have something to do with the kind of disclosure that you give to somebody and tell them what they're consenting to and what it means that there is a certificate of confidentiality and what the limits on that are. And, of course, we're not really sure what those limits are, but there's at least in one example that is not favorable for data subjects in this kind of trial.
Please forward that citation if you have it. I'm sure the GW would very much want to make sure that that's included.
I'll see if I can scrounge it up.
Great, thank you. I had never heard that.
Thank you. So I'm going to move us along. Danielle, I'm bringing up the next one, okay?
Okay. So this scenario is sort of very broadly looking at the issue of consent with individuals that have some kind of decisional impairments. And the reason it's fairly broad is because the scenario is related to how we might follow an unselected longitudinal cohort in the case where they may be coming in and out of different levels of decisional impairment. So there's things, as we know, that happen to individuals that may be permanent, for example, permanent neurological damage, and there's issues that may be temporary, from which they could recover. And this raised some questions around who might be authorized to offer the kinds of consent, what kinds of evaluations would be required in order to make a statement about the determination about the ability that somebody would have to consent, and whether or not there was some kind of joint responsibility for offering consent or assent. And this had actually also created a number of interesting conversations offline, and so we're very interested in hearing your thoughts about it. So, the questions that we had brought up here was whether the research team is obligated to remove patients' data if there had not been the ability to obtain consent, or the ability for the proxy to offer consent. As we know, sometimes in these longitudinal studies, loss to follow-up is fairly frequent, and particularly if the decisional impairment was something that came into the researchers' knowledge, what kind of obligations do they have for maintaining the data. Some of the issues around cooperative consent came up, whether there needed to be some joint consent given by a proxy and the subjects themselves, and whether or not there were adequate tests for decisional impairment, and whether those kinds of tests were sufficient for a subject to truly understand the details of the data privacy concerns. So this again is to sort of point out the differences between consenting to participate in a procedure and participating in a study that might involve some privacy risks. And then what are the ways that a proxy might be compensated if they're continuing to act on behalf of the patient in these kinds of consents? And the description here is below. When we have these longitudinal studies, tracking consent and managing that information over time, and then managing the different actors in that process can become something that is fairly complex. And what kinds of information should we be working with in order to make sure that this is ethically handled, and we're keeping the autonomy of the participant in mind while also making sure that their interests are represented in these cases where they may be decisionally impaired. So I'll pause and open it up here. Are there any questions that we didn't raise that we should be concerned about in these cases? And the spectrum of decisional impairment has also been something that has come up in some of these conversations. And are there special things that we should be thinking about when we're discussing people that might be in a transitional state of impairment versus something that is permanent?
Thanks, Daniela. Does anyone have any questions or comments?
So
Priscilla,
I thought you did a good job of characterizing some of the conversations that you had with me anyway. This is Leslie Francis.
Thank you, Leslie. There was another comment. Please go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, this is Allison Ryan. I was wondering whether or not it just begs the question of needing to elicit consent on a periodic basis, so not just once but on a rolling basis, which I think you're sort of alluding to, but it seems a little bit different to have the two time points being sort of, when they're potentially impaired and then when they're not versus setting in place an infrastructure to keep asking that question and then ask, well, then what do you do with the data from the past cycles of asking that question and collecting it?
So are we asking whether the impairment is permanent or temporary? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, it's sort of assuming that we don't know whether it's temporary or permanent in many
permanent,
cases.
Permanent, right, yeah.
Then does that mean at the outset that you design your consent process to account for that and therefore require that you have multiple intervals, I don't know what those are, where you have to sort of reassess that question. And then your access to those data are only as flexible or allowable as the response to the last question or the last time period in which that was elicited.
I have a follow-up question to that because this was something that came up in discussion. So potentially some of the data sources that might be accessible to researchers in this kind of scenario might have information about their medical records that would indicate that they were at least at risk for not being able to actively consent. Do you think that there is an obligation on the part of the research team to should that kind of information come into their data stores? Do you think there's an obligation that they should be trying to follow up and obtain a reconsent or some kind of contact with a proxy under those circumstances, or do you think it applies under cases of minimal risk versus greater than minimal risk, depending on the study? I'm interested in how that plays out from an ethical standpoint.
Yeah, well, and so I'm not an ethicist, and so I'm not sure I'm actually in a good position to answer from an ethical standpoint, but from somebody who believes in consent from a philosophical standpoint, I would say yes. But, maybe then there is more of a calculation of, as you were suggesting, the potential risks, and I would sort of defer to the IRB and the other powers that be, if you will. But I think it's a relevant sort of question to ask. If you want there to be meaningful consent, what does that actually look like for this type of a population?
So IRBs will consider whether there are choice points. For example, some IRBs require going back to people who were entered into studies as children to reconsent them for any future use of data. Typically, the past use of data stays, but it could certainly be the case that an IRB might, depending on the risks, want to include re-review of consent for patients with declining capabilities. And it's something that researchers ought to think about. I think some of it depends on the risks and benefits of the study as well.
This is Tani Elwee from the VA Health Services Research and Development, and I don't want to sound provocative, but I'm just wondering how that differs in some ways from just consent in general, because even if you have somebody who doesn't have decisional difficulties or issues, I mean, if I consent to a study now, in 5 years maybe I would feel differently. So if somebody was to call me and ask me, did I still want to
be part of that study, I might change my mind, but that might not have anything to do with my decisional ability. So I'm just thinking about that, just sort of playing, you know, devil's advocate from just a practical research perspective.
You know, I think the question is in part whether circumstances have changed sufficiently so that people might consent differently. And there's no reason to think your circumstances would have changed. I also think one of the things that's interesting about these proposals or about this kind of data use is it's anticipated to be very long-term gathering of data. In a way, a lot of research studies are not. But, well.
So, I wanted to give, Bob, did you have another comment? Your hand is
Yeah, I did. It's relatively minor. On the question about compensation, I think is inartfully phrased. It suggests that should, you know, the representatives be provided compensation for consenting the participant. Of course, whatever compensation there should be for, you know, making a decision should be neutral. And it gets more complicated, however, if there is to be, you know, a stream of compensation that continues over years if there is other activity required on the part of the representative. But in terms of just the original consent, you have to compensate someone, if you're doing that, for making the decision, whatever the decision has to be.
If your points are taken, we can certainly sort of, you know, define that. Other questions, comments, or observations? Okay, so if folks have other comments on any of these scenarios, you can certainly sort of, you know, reach out to the NORC team outside of this call. And, you know, there will be other opportunities to also comment on these, okay? So this is not sort of your last chance to give us input. Janina, I'm going to move us on to the next one, and I'm going to hand it over to you, okay?
Okay. Okay, so this case is related to satisfying preconditions for a number of our other scenarios. I think that it's probably familiar to many people that commented on the combining data sets case, and anybody that has been trying to work with merging data from different sources, either in order to make sure that there are not duplicate patients across different data sources or to link records across different care settings. And so the case here is meant to support two possible scenarios. One is to accurately re-identify current and potential research participants. And the second one is what we have discussed before, is in order to link data, to create a single record from something that might be distributed across multiple sources, including research sources. But the complexities in this case primarily are in at least in my experience, around the risks and liabilities that are incurred to the organizations that might be trying to create research unique identifiers. So the most common approach that I'm aware of uses a match approach as opposed to a deterministic approach, because deterministic identifiers, even social security numbers, tend to be captured fairly inaccurately across different sources. So in order to make the matches, the most common data that's used is data that would be considered personally identifying information, including social security numbers, account numbers, names, addresses, phone numbers. This information isn't necessarily connected to the health data when identifiers are being formed, but if they come from the healthcare system, they would be associated with a particular setting or a payer. The approaches can be either deterministic across those identifiers, requiring all of the different fields match, and that would determine that you have the same patient across two different sources, or a probabilistic where you have a somewhat more inexact method where there's a level of uncertainty about how well a certain record can be matched. And usually patients are not involved in this process. That's true for both creating research identifiers and creating identifiers for treatment, payment, and operations. This is a challenge when we look at what we have with the HIPAA guidelines for creating research identifiers. There's not a lot of implementation information around how you should create identifiers across multiple institutions. In fact, there's some precautions that are expressed in HIPAA about whether or not encryption algorithms can actually be shared outside of an organization that creates these kinds of research identifiers. And so this list of questions includes some of the things that we have talked about peripherally in other scenarios, but I wanted to call out here specifically. So the first one is related to, you know, who is actually managing these kinds of record linkage systems. So, you know, in theory, this could be managed by research participants. It could be managed by a research organization or a party acting on behalf of the research organization, sometimes called an honest broker. And the operationally managed systems that might already be part of health information exchanges or other kinds of multi-institutional collaborations, payer organizations that have that kind of ability to merge records. There's different kinds of workflows that might be involved if we're trying to create identifiers on a project by project basis versus creating identifiers that would be maintained as part of an infrastructure for networks or registries or other kinds of initiatives that would contemplate having these really long-term data assets that would be able to add additional patients or participants over time, spanning multiple different kinds of projects. Then there's some questions that I would like to hear from you guys, whether or not your IRBs and privacy offices are well prepared to address this kind of question. I might be projecting my personal experience onto others, but my experience has been that these questions have been quite challenging and caused a lot of deliberation among the legal and IRBs trying to make decisions on how to handle these kinds of identifiers. And this solution of trying to get participants to self-manage this kind of linkage is an intriguing one, but it may actually limit quite extensively both the extent of the population that might be able to participate in and get their linked data, depending on what the barriers were to entry, which can be quite high. And then these next two questions are sort of over whether or not cryptographic approaches can address concerns that might be related to privacy when organizations would be sharing information across their institutional boundaries. And so there's a patient's privacy concerns, and then there's also the concerns of the liable parties, which are regulated and could potentially be found liable for either a large-scale breach or even an individual identity being disclosed unintentionally through this process. And then we've found that health information exchanges have been leveraged in order to create these kinds of identifiers. And I wanted to hear from you guys if anybody had actually tried using this kind of approach and what the implications might be for researchers to rely on third parties that are part of the operations for this kind of practice. These are the questions, and some of them I would like to hear if any of you guys have answers for them or any other things that might be raised that haven't been covered in these questions. Because this is a precondition for a lot of other scenarios, hearing how you guys might address this kind of problem would be very interesting here.
Thanks, Daniela. So any questions, comments, observations from your own experiences from folks on the phone? Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So no, I think that this is hugely critical and matches some of the other use cases. I mean, I've reviewed the PCORnet demonstration studies, and for example, even in the adaptable study where informed consent is obtained, you know, there's a statement in the adaptable trial that says primary identifiers will be retained only within the data systems where required to conduct the study. These will be omitted as data travel downstream and only study IDs will be in the analytic data sets. And while that's true, there's a lack of the disclosure even to the patient about needing to disclose this information for the purposes of doing the linkage. Like, you can't call up a health plan and say, I need the data on study ID 13. So this is a hugely important topic. I stress how difficult this is. I don't know that I have solutions. I did have a phone call yesterday with one HIE of five in the state of New York, and it's an uphill climb trying to figure out how to get provisions for research into HIEs to do the linkage.
Thanks, Kevin. So I don't think Eddie's on the call, but I think we should mention that, you know, we also did speak to Ed Hammond, and, you know, he had some of sort of the ideas that we've embraced in the discussion here today. Other questions or comments about this one?
So this is Allison. I would echo the prior speaker's comment about how important this issue is. And I just noted that one of the questions you've posed is whether or not IRBs and legal and privacy offices are well prepared to make determinations on the question. And I would say, based on our experiences and discussions, the answer is no. So I'm sure that there's a huge level of variability, which is part of the problem, but it seems like a huge area of need.
I mean, I guess, you know, Daniela asked this, but, you know, in terms of, I mean, you know, we do have some folks that are very actively engaged with sort of research at the moment. How are you sort of, I mean, what are your experiences with the IRB? And, you know, where do you see some of the sort of the sticking points with respect to this?
So this is Kevin again. I mean, with HealthCare and sort of from a health plan perspective, I think what's really, really challenging is, for years when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, I would write into my IRB, you know, no data is going to leave this facility. Everything's going to be on a server behind two locked closed doors, et cetera. And that, then you would be getting that waiver of authorization from, you know, an academic IRB. But now we're entering the era where we don't just want the data from the University of Pennsylvania. We need that linkage. So we're sort of breaking that. And then we want to move in the direction of having a sort of IRBs ceding to other IRBs, but a challenge that I see is still, it's not sort of an academic IRB's responsibility to be playing, you know, granting a waiver for authorization from some other entity. So then that opens up the door of, well, now I got to get IRB from everywhere that I'm going to be doing this type of linkage. And I think that adds a barrier. I think it's partly a needed barrier, but partly we need to think about how that's going to impact our ability to do research when we need to be disclosing this information for the purposes of the conduct of linkage.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kevin.
I guess I could pose this question another way, too. I mean, has anybody had a particularly good experience where they felt that there was a very skilled group of multi-institutional representatives from legal and privacy and IRBs that really managed to nail down this problem in a way that streamlined all of the challenges associated with using potentially identifying information and likely identifying information in order to facilitate these kinds of linkages? I think that, you know, an example would be a wonderful thing to add to this, you know, to this body of work here.
And I don't see anyone raising their hands to say they've solved this.
So I this is Allison. I can't offer an example, but I wonder whether or not it's worth posing that question directly of the folks at the Maryland HIE CRISP, or just some other. I mean, I maybe you've already done this, so I apologize if it's a if it's a non-starter. But I wonder if they would have an example. Because they are, you know, using that platform for to support some research effort.
Thanks, Allison. We could certainly, you know, follow up with, you know, with the folks at CRISP. I think we know them to see what they might be doing here. So I'm going to. Are there any other questions, comments, or observations on this one? Daniel, I think it may be worth mentioning that, you know, we may reach out to a few folks on the phone separately outside of this call, as we've done with some of the other scenarios. So, you know, you'll definitely hear from us. And then, you know, we are also talking to a group at ONC that's led by Debbie Bucci, and they also doing some related work. So we, you know, obviously I think we want to make sure that, you know, what we work on here is sort of complementary, you know, to those efforts. So just, you know, something else to make our stakeholders aware of. Okay.
I just got a message from Jason Doctor. Jason, do you have something to add?
I don't know. Can people hear me? I'm sorry, I'm not on the go-to meeting.
Yeah, Jason, we can hear you. Not in here. Go ahead.
I just was going to comment that, you know, the standard approach for combining or streamlining IRBs across institutions is cumbersome, and that's, you know, using a memorandum of understanding. So, you know, one option would be for there to be some other type of document that allows for another type of memorandum of understanding that would streamline approval for use of network data. This is, you know, uncharted territory, but that's the type of thing that you would need in order for an IRB to cede to another IRB approval across, you know, five or six institutions.
This is Bob Gelman. Could I raise another point? I think this is you know, obviously a very important scenario, and the questions raised here are really good. And the complication I just want to throw in, and I don't know if we've discussed this before, is if you think this is messy, and it is, just assume that some of the data is going to cross an international border because the international privacy rules are generally much stricter and data can often only flow in one direction. And there are just a host of problems.
I'm so sad that you brought that up because we were on the phone with a lawyer yesterday that raised this issue, and I was hoping that it wasn't going to be something that would be generally a problem. But yeah, I guess we could add that to the list of concerns. Thank you.
So again, thank you. So anyone has any other comments, observations, you can certainly email us, and you know, we can set up sort of a separate discussion with you all, okay? So I guess I just want to bring up a couple of more things. Just sort of mostly to make you aware of some of the other scenarios that you know, we've either sort of received from you and extrapolated on sort of, you know, individual calls. But, you know, we are looking at some additional combining data scenarios to bring in other data types, including social services information. So those are some areas that we will be exploring in the coming weeks. We've had some interesting ideas around precision medicine. And so you sort of, you know, sort of see this reflected here in terms of sort of managing privacy related to genetic data, use of genetic biomarkers for research. You know, this idea of disclosure of genetic data to a minor, I think, was something that we received via email from some of the folks on this call. And then, you know, we are also looking at sort of some scenarios around non-genetic precision medicine research. We will be working sort of closely with ONC and, you know, the team at the NIH as we expand on these ideas and sort of refine them. But if there are any other ideas around sort of precision medicine that individuals on the phone have, you know, please feel free to get in touch with us. Okay. Another topic that has sort of bubbled up in a number of these discussions is around sort of re-identification risks. So we'll be, you know, building out a scenario or scenarios related to that. Two others that have sort of come up are research on small and subpopulations and one on underrepresented populations. And so we, you know, we'll be discussing some areas of further exploration with ONC, and we'll bring them up for conversation here at this meeting as well. We've had some ideas on patient-generated health data, so we are very actively looking at a scenario around patient-reported outcomes into a registry that builds up some work that's going on in California. But we are very interested to see if there are other ideas around, you know, patient-generated health data that, you know, you feel we should explore as well, okay? So just some topics that, you know, have come up and, you know, they are sort of under consideration at the moment. So just to remind everyone on the phone, you all have access to sort of the Confluence website, and we do have a form on Confluence where you can certainly, you know, give us any ideas that you have. But I think we've noticed that a number of the, you know, multi-stakeholder groups have sort of reached out to us via email, and that works just great as well. So you can email us, and, you know, we've had a number of one-on-one calls, which we have found to be very helpful in helping us sort of frame up the issues and build out the scenarios. So we will continue doing that, okay? So just in terms of review of progress, so a couple of things. You know, we now have, I think, sort of quite a few scenarios that, you know, we started to build out and refine with feedback from you all. We've been posting all of the materials on Confluence. I actually just wanted to bring up one other thing. So for some of the earlier scenarios, so the first three scenarios that we've discussed with this group were one on combining data sets, the other was on integration of behavioral health data and physical health data, and then we had one on the secondary analysis of administrative data on substance abuse. So for each of those three scenarios, we've actually added a form that will allow you to give us some feedback on these scenarios. So, you know, if you go to Confluence, and we will send out the link to everyone on this call and all the other participants. And so if you click on the email, you'll be taken to this form, okay, which will allow you to give us sort of feedback on the scenario. So I know there's some people on the call that, you know, have emailed us some feedback, and we've been sort of folding that in. But this is sort of another reach out to you to see if there's any other feedback on some of the initial scenarios that we've discussed with you. You know, we would appreciate you sort of either filling in this form or sort of emailing us with any observations, okay? The other sort of quick point I wanted to make was, you know, in subsequent, so as we refine the scenarios, and once we feel that we've gotten to them, you know, we've gotten them to a point where, you know, we'd like to get sort of your inputs, we'll be posting these forms and sort of making you aware. And then, you know, toward the end of sort of the cycle where we've been meeting with you every 2 weeks, you know, we'll go through a process where we discuss each of the scenarios again, you know, just to make sure that we've captured all of the salient issues and if there's any, you know, anything else that you all want to bring up at that point. So anyway, there's a long way of saying that, you know, there's multiple times in which, you know, you can give us input on these calls, outside of these calls, via email and using the Confluence website, okay? And I guess the last thing just to mention, so we have our next meeting on March 2nd, so we look forward to sort of, you know, seeing you all at that meeting. I've just talked about, you know, the three areas where we're going to be asking for your input. So you'll see a link from us on that. Just as a reminder, you know, we have all of the meeting summaries, audio recordings from the meeting, and the scenarios themselves all on the website. So you're welcome to sort of look at that, you know, outside of this call, okay? And just sort of, I'll close by saying that we have sort of, you know, the meeting schedule, and at this point, everyone should have a calendar hold for these upcoming meetings. We have 2 minutes left, so are there any other comments, questions, observations from anyone on the call before we wrap up today? That, and I want to say thank you very much. We appreciate everyone's time, and you will be hearing more from us via email. Thank you very much, everyone.